is from Creighton University, the author of Radical Virtues. And if you aren't familiar with the book, I would recommend it as a really interesting contemporary account of the virtues, and one that works very well if somebody says, well, what is all this about virtue theory, or how can I have a book that kind of introduces me to a distinction of what the various virtues are and so forth. It's really a wonderful book, and we're delighted that you came to our conference this year to speak about temperance. So, welcome.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to begin on a personal note, and that is to say that my great-grandfather, James Udy, was an itinerant Methodist preacher who spread the word of God in Cornwall, England, more than 100 years ago. James Udy sought to save souls. He warned people about the danger of the demon drink, and he was himself a temperance lecturer of the old school. So today I'm giving a lecture on temperance. I doubt if my great-grandfather would approve of everything I have to say about the ancient and modern versions of temperance. But I think we would share a sense of the importance of this virtue, which in recent times has been unfairly neglected. So let me begin, and my hope is that through continuing discussion and conferences like this one at Viterbo University, we can recover the wisdom of temperance from the oblivion into which it has recently fallen. Different cultures have different virtues, or at least they prioritize the forms of human excellence in different ways. And even within the same society, the nature of virtues and vices may change periodically from one age to the next. There are some virtues, like courage or justice, which seem to be universal. On the other hand, there are some virtues that become more or less important as time goes by. Temperance is one of these. Plato, like other Greeks, considered it one of the four cardinal virtues. The early Christians exalted it, but in modern times, its standing has diminished. This should prompt us to examine temperance from both an historical and a philosophical perspective. For we cannot grasp the significance of any of the virtues unless we understand their historical filiation as well as their ethical point. Like temperance, chastity was also considered a great virtue in classical antiquity. In the sense of sexual purity, it was one of the defining virtues for women, as opposed to courage, which was the definitive virtue for men. With the advent of Christianity, chastity and a commitment to virginity became a sign of the most complete devotion to religious life. In a famous passage that is often misquoted, St. Paul comments, "To the unmarried and widows I say that it is well for them to remain single as I do. But if they cannot exercise self-control, they should marry. For it is better to marry than to be aflame with passion." This passage implies that sexual continence within marriage is an acceptable option, but that celibacy for men and women is a much greater virtue, since it represents a sacrifice of worldly desire and complete devotion to the will of God. The chastity is not so highly regarded in contemporary Western society, and for the most part, virginity seems to be viewed as a lifestyle choice that should be respected, but not a virtue that everyone is bound to affirm. A similar point can be made about humility, which, as Nietzsche says, the Romans scorned and the Christians exalted. Humility has strong undertones of self-abnegation, and it may be inspired by a fear of anything exceptional. And so today we are ambivalent about humility. And while there are some contexts in which we may think of it as a virtue, there are situations in which it is definitely a vice. In the end, the virtues that we admire must always correspond to the way that we represent our society to ourselves. In a self-consciously religious society, self-denial, obedience, temperance, and humility will be more highly valued as individual virtues, while in contemporary Western culture, they are less highly esteemed because they seem to conflict with popular values such as personal fulfillment, autonomy, and the enjoyment of life. All of which shows the real difficulty of tracing the progress of any particular virtue, even if we remain within the same cultural horizons. And it's even more difficult to follow a particular virtue, like temperance, from one culture to another, as if it were a separate, self-contained form of goodness that remains the same, regardless of its context. With these warnings in place, we can now focus more closely on the virtue of temperance as moderation and self-control. Temperance is derived from the Greek ideal of sophrosune, which means having a sound mind or mental health. It can also be understood as calmness of soul, self-control, or the awareness of human limits and the refusal of overreaching pride. In Greek philosophy, Socrates is portrayed as the very image of temperance, while in the Republic, the tyrant is presented as an immoderate man, completely lacking in self-control. He cannot rule himself, and so he is the worst possible person to rule over others. Aristotle's discussion of temperance is framed within the context of our animal desires and pleasures, and he shows how the achievement of temperance is also the achievement of a proper relationship to our physical nature. Later, the virtue of temperance was appropriated by Christianity. As Foucault has shown, under Christianity, temperance becomes identified with purity, and the importance of virginity or chastity, even within marriage, are among its obvious aspects. Many of the early Christians thought that they could root out the promptings of sexual desire and overcome ordinary human nature to become the perfect servants of God. In this way, temperance became more closely associated with self-denial. While in recent times, the growth of temperance movements against alcohol and other forms of intoxication seems to continue this very particular view that temperance involves the refusal of everything associated with self-indulgence. Today, temperance is practically equivalent to moderation. It seems opposed to all the exuberance of life and emphasizes the importance of self-restraint. We want to be small, Nietzsche might say. We are afraid of anything exceptional or extreme. And so we praise temperance because we are mediocre, and we are only comfortable with the virtues of mediocrity. But what does all of this signify? Are we to say that the contemporary decline and fall of temperance as a virtue is just the unraveling of its own internal contradictions and a sign of its irrelevance? That temperance, along with chastity and humility, are outmoded ideals? Or do we need to rehabilitate temperance as a virtue because we have lost a sense of its original significance and importance, and it is precisely this that we need now? In this paper, I want to argue for the latter position, for I think that the ancient estimation of temperance as one of the most significant virtues is the expression of a profound moral understanding. And I want to reclaim a meaningful version of temperance that articulates a space of moral goodness that is associated with our relationship to nature. We have seen how Nietzsche criticizes the way in which virtues like temperance have been appropriated and made small. This criticism derives from the standpoint that the virtues should be an expression of strength. In what follows, I show how temperance can involve the achievement of personal sovereignty and the attunement of the self with the world, which entails individual strength and well-being. I begin with the genealogy of sophrosune, or the development of temperance from Plato to Christianity and beyond. In the second part of the paper, I argue for a revaluation of temperance in terms of our attunement with nature that emphasizes self-cultivation, measure, and the awareness of limits. And this leads to a discussion of environmentalism as the fulfillment of temperance on a global scale. It is true that the current state of pollution, species endangerment, and overdevelopment in the world may require massive forms of intervention, and only a general environmental policy can be deduced from the outline of a virtue. But we must still return to temperance as the underlying care and concern for nature, which promotes a sense of belonging to the world and a sense of the interrelationship of everything that exists. And whether we think of ecology as a form of extended self-interest or virtuous self-denial, temperance can guide all our actions, judgments, and feelings about the natural world. Sophrosyne, or temperance, is a major theme in many of the Greek tragedies. For even a cursory reading of these plays makes it clear that for the Greeks, there was a natural order to things, and human beings must learn to accept their place within the cosmos. Such is the virtue of Sophrosyne. But ignoring human limitations or meddling in divine matters is an expression of hubris, and it's bound to end in disaster. To give an obvious example, in Euripides' play, The Bacchae, Pentheus is the strict proponent of rational self-control, and he is outraged by the new Dionysian cult and the challenge to the social order that it seems to entail, with women abandoning their place in the household to worship a strange new god in the mountains. From one perspective, Pentheus seems to be the perfect model of temperance as rational self-constraint. And yet, Euripides shows, authentic temperance goes much deeper than this. Pentheus is unbalanced because he refuses to acknowledge the divinity of nature. By moving against Dionysus, the god, and his followers, he shows a complete lack of temperance and a willful self-assertion that leads to his own humiliation and death. The symposium is about love. And when Socrates speaks about it, he describes a force that is first revealed through the physical attractiveness of a particular individual who wrenches us out of our self-containment. But then he describes a progress in the different forms of love, which finally culminates in the love of the good and the total self-containment of the philosopher who seems to need nothing and no one beyond himself. Quote, "And having brought forth and nurtured true goodness, he will have the privilege of being beloved of God and becoming, if ever a man can, immortal himself." At this point, Alcibiades enters with some other drunken revelers, and he makes it clear that Socrates himself is the epitome of the self-contained philosopher that has just been described. Alcibiades disdains philosophical argument, and he doesn't speak in general praise of love, but in the space of a few pages, he offers us a compelling portrait of Socrates as someone who exemplifies the virtue of temperance. What fascinates Alcibiades is the allure of self-possession that Socrates projects. Socrates has complete control over all his desires, and he seems to be in touch with a higher wisdom that others around him can sense and are also attracted to. It's not that he has eradicated all of his desires and lives at a minimal level of intensity. Indeed, Alcibiades compares Socrates to the figure of Silenus sold in statuary shops. He looks like the satyr, but once you look beneath the surface, you will discover a degree of self-control of which you can hardly form a notion. Alcibiades describes all of his attempts to get Socrates to sleep with him. He thinks that somehow he will gain access to Socrates' secret wisdom through a physical relationship with him. But Socrates rebuffs him, not because he is cold and without desire, but because he doesn't need Alcibiades to be complete. The point is that Socrates has achieved sophrosune, and so he is able to keep all of his desires and appetites in their proper place. As Alcibiades comments, on the one hand, I realized that I had been slighted, but on the other, I felt a reverence for Socrates' character, his self-control and courage. I have met a man whose like for wisdom and fortitude I could never have expected to encounter. Further evidence is given of Socrates' ability to endure hardship without complaint and his indifference to physical conditions. In the military campaign, he endured the icy cold, lack of sleep, and lack of food better than anyone else. But when supplies were abundant, we're told, no one enjoyed them more, at drinking especially, though he drank only when he was forced to. He was invincible, and yet, what is most remarkable of all, no human being has ever seen Socrates drunk. Once again, the point is not that he was indifferent to his physical well-being, but his temperance involved the achievement of personal sovereignty and the harmonious arrangement of all the different aspects of his life. At the end of the symposium, we are left with the image of Socrates still awake and alert, long after everyone else has succumbed to alcohol and fatigue. Then Socrates, having put both his interlocutors to sleep, got up and went away. He went to the Lyceum and washed, and spent the day as he would any other, and finally, towards evening, went home to bed. What is so striking about this description is the effortlessness of Socrates' behavior. He is not a heroic soul who struggles against temptation to achieve virtue by self-mastery. And even though temperance may require self-restraint and resistance to temptation, he is by now so well-ordered that whatever unruly impulses he has are immediately set aside. In contrast to this portrait of Socrates, Plato also gives us the figure of the tyrant as the unhappiest man who is totally subject to his own desires. Earlier in the Republic, the tyrant is praised as the most fortunate of all men who is able to gratify whatever desires he has whenever they occur to him. But in Book 9, Socrates argues that such a life is ultimately wretched. Since there is no need to practice self-restraint, the tyrant is not prone to possess temperance, and he loses whatever self-control he might have had once he comes into office. Numerous examples come to mind in support of Plato's analysis. Stalin had most of his revolutionary comrades purged because he couldn't trust them, and he was especially fearful of any colleagues who approached him in popularity. Hitler, Mao, and Pol Pot thought they could only maintain their rule through the continual threat of violence that would keep people obedient through fear. But in these circumstances, all genuine friendship becomes impossible, and the ruler is himself a prisoner of his own oppressive regime. As Plato puts it, isn't the tyrant bound in such a prison, he who has a nature such as we describe, full of many fears and loves of all kinds? And he, whose soul is so gourmand, alone of the men in the city, can't go anywhere abroad or see all the things the other free men desire to see. But, stuck in his house for the most part, he lives like a woman, envying any of the other citizens who travel abroad and see anything good. In sum, the tyrant is the least self-sufficient man. He is dependent on external things, and he is full of anxiety. Significantly, the tyrant is often described as effeminate. The tyrant has no self-control. He is subject to whatever passion arises within his soul, and in this respect, he is the opposite of the strong masculine personality who is self-controlled and therefore capable of ruling over others. For the Greeks, temperance does not involve weak desires. It's actually the sign of ethical virility. As Foucault puts it, self-mastery was a way of being a man with respect to oneself. That is, a way of commanding what needed commanding, of coercing what was not capable of self-direction, of imposing principles of reason on what was wanting in reason. In short, it was a way of being active in relation to what was by nature passive and ought to remain so. In this ethics of men made for men, the development of the self as an ethical subject consisted in setting up a structure of virility that related oneself to oneself. Hence, in the Republic, the choice is finally between the immoderate and effeminate life of the tyrant, which is so seductive and alluring, and the life of temperance, which is embodied by the philosopher, and more particularly in the person of Socrates himself. The philosopher king achieves this self-moderation, and so he is the most appropriate individual to rule the state. Temperance involves self-discipline and a harmonious adjustment to the good society, but it also involves a relationship to the cosmos itself. Plato makes this clear in the Gorgias, when Callicles refuses to discuss anything further, and Socrates has to assert these conclusions as if they were revealed truth. Again, a quote. "Then the goodness of anything is due to order and arrangement." I should agree. "It is then the presence in each thing of the order appropriate to it that makes everything good." So it appears to me. "The soul, then, that has its own appropriate order is better than that which has none, necessarily. But further, the soul possessed of order is orderly, of course, and the orderly is the temperate, most necessarily. Then the temperate soul is the good." Socrates goes on to assert that the idea of temperance is an essential aspect of the universe itself, and whoever possesses a harmonious or temperate soul is in accordance with the basic order of the universe and most available to himself, his city, and others. Again, wise men, Callicles, say that the heavens and the earth, gods and men, are bound together by fellowship and friendship, and order and temperance and justice. And for this reason, they call the sum of things the ordered universe, my friend, not the world of disorder or riot. But it seems to me that you pay no attention to these things, in spite of your wisdom. But you are unaware that geometric equality is of great importance among gods and men alike, and you think we should practice overreaching others, for you neglect geometry. Callicles had argued for the life of the tyrant as the greatest good of all, and rejected justice and temperance as a fraud perpetrated by the weak. Socrates' argument brings out the limitation of this perspective, and again, the total isolation and misery of those who are completely self-involved. In the end, we are impressed by temperance as the virtue that connects the inner being with the outer reality and allows us to live harmoniously in the world. In Aristotle, the discussion of temperance is organized through the idea of the mean. Temperance is the calm state of soul that lies between self-indulgence and total self-denial. But the mean itself is an expression of the principle of temperance. And so Aristotle views temperance both as a specific virtue, like self-control, and as the harmonious condition of soul that involves a fundamental attunement with ourselves and the world. And this is the precondition for all virtue. Aristotle advances the discussion of temperance in Book 7 of the Nicomachean Ethics, where he considers the distinction between continence, incontinence, and temperance. The incontinent person, akrasis, is someone who knows what is right, but who lacks the strength of will to do what is right, or is swayed by the possibility of a more immediate gratification. Aristotle says that Socrates denied the very possibility of such acratic actions. Since Socrates believed that one cannot resist the power of the good, evil doing was only possible because of ignorance and faulty understanding of the nature of goodness. Aristotle then spends a considerable part of Book 7 trying to unravel the riddle of acratic actions and to show how weakness of the will is possible. But he forgets the example of Alcibiades in Plato's Symposium. As we've seen, Alcibiades is in awe of Socrates, and when he is around Socrates, he admits he is ashamed. In his pursuit of fame and political success, Alcibiades has ignored the most important needs of his soul. But when he is around Socrates, he knows that he is not living his life in the right way. Quote, "He is the only person in whose presence I experience a sensation of which I might be thought incapable," he admits, "a sensation of shame. He, and he alone, positively makes me ashamed of myself. The reason is that I am conscious that there is no arguing against the conclusion that one should do as he bids, and yet that whenever I am away from him, I succumb to the temptations of popularity. So I behave like a runaway slave and take to my heels, and when I see him, the conclusions which he has forced upon me make me ashamed." Presumably, Alcibiades is able to ignore Socrates because even though he recognizes that Socrates is right, this is not a truth he has been able to incorporate at the deepest level of his being. He both knows and yet doesn't know the truth of Socrates' philosophy. And in this sense, he embodies Aristotle's own philosophical position on incontinence. Nor does the incontinent man know what is right in the sense of actively contemplating it. Only as a person asleep or drunk can be said to know a thing. The incontinent man is like a state which passes all the right decrees and has good laws, but makes no use of them. Aristotle comments briefly and in passing on the very few people who seem to be opposed to physical enjoyment or even incapable of physical pleasure. Of course, the great majority of people are prone to self-indulgence, but Aristotle does mention the insensibility to pleasure as a vice that as yet has no name. Given what he knew of human nature, Aristotle didn't think that insensibility to pleasure could ever be a serious problem. The irony is that at the end of classical antiquity, Christianity emerged as a popular movement which emphasized asceticism, the denial of the flesh, and self-mortification for the sake of the world to come. Now, of course, if we use examples from the early church fathers, it would be quite easy to show how Christianity has promoted a negative attitude to the body. The early Christians, in particular, seemed to cultivate an exceptional sexual discipline, which signified their distinction from the rest of the pagan world. Many early Christians pledged themselves to virginity and chastity even within marriage. They rejected divorce and disapproved of remarriage. The leaders of the early church practiced celibacy and sought to overcome sexual desire to achieve a singleness of purpose that would allow them to be devoted to God. As Peter Brown writes, "In such a way, celibacy demarcated quite unmistakably the existence of a class of persons who were central to the public life of the church, precisely because they were permanently removed from what was considered most private in the life of the average Christian layman in the world." For many of the early Christians, the goal was to achieve supremacy over this world by renouncing physical pleasure, especially sexual pleasure, and becoming indifferent to physical pain. Hence, the much criticized Tertullian, who called for the public veiling of women and girls, who railed against public entertainments, and insisted that the sin of the fallen angels was a lack of chastity. Hence the extreme case of the ascetic desert fathers, or the pillared squatting saints like St. Simeon Stylites, who lived for years at the top of a 60-foot platform in the desert, fasting, praying, and experiencing extreme physical hardship, and at the same time achieving immense fame. Such examples exalt an ideal that involves repudiation of worldly pleasure and scorn for personal pain and suffering. For in this way, the individual is supposedly made pure from the corruption of the world. Of course, Tertullian is later considered a heretic, and the desert saints can be seen as fanatics, while more mainstream Christian writers, like St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas, accept the necessity of marriage and sexual activity. But even in St. Augustine and Aquinas, there is still a sense that the sensual is something to be resisted, since it is the inferior element of creation. This implies a dualism of spirit and matter, and the path to perfection involves renunciation of the lower sphere, insofar as this is possible in this world. St. Augustine is the presiding genius of Christian theology who responds to underlying themes and anxieties of the Christian mind at the same time as he clarifies and organizes Christian doctrines. The Confessions and the City of God reflect the Christian preoccupation with physical desire as the basis of our sinful nature. Clearly for Augustine, as well as for other Christian thinkers, the essential task is the purification of all that offends against the spiritual will. It would be best if we could live without it, but given our sinful nature, we must remain suspicious of our physical being. We must confine it to the proper forms of heterosexual monogamy, and, as confessors were instructed, we should be on the lookout for every manifestation of improper thought and act. Augustine says, I quote, "It is right, therefore, to be ashamed of this lust, and it is right that the members which it moves or fails to move by its own right, so to speak, and not in complete conformity to our decision, should be called pudenda, parts of shame, which they were not called before man sinned. For as Scripture tells us, they were naked, and yet they felt no embarrassment." Clearly, this is a very different account of temperance than the one we examined in ancient Greek philosophy. But in one way or another, it informs most of the thinkers in the Christian tradition, including those thinkers who are critical in rejecting some of the excesses of the so-called monkish virtues. In the Summa Theologiae, for example, Aquinas gives an extended and thoughtful account of temperance that attempts to realign Christianity within an Aristotelian frame. Temperance concerns the desires that are most necessary to the life of the individual and the continuation of the species. Aquinas doesn't call for the suppression of these desires, and yet he declares that chastity and virginity are the purest forms of temperance. Marriage, he says, is for the body's good, whereas virginity is for the good of the soul in the life of contemplation. Hence, quote, "Without doubt, virginity is to be esteemed more highly than conjugal continence." Aquinas argues that some people serve the community through marriage and bearing children, while others serve the community through their religious devotion. This seems like a statement of equality. In this respect, bearing children is a good thing, for without it the community would perish, and Aquinas is certainly not one of the radical deniers of the flesh who calls for complete self-mortification. And yet, he has to agree with Augustine, in the end, that marriage is a necessary evil, and virginity for the sake of Christian service is a more exalted state than marriage itself. I quote, "It is thus that virginity, dedicated to God, is ranked higher than bodily fruitfulness." And so Augustine writes, "It must be confessed that the fruitfulness of the flesh, even for women of our day who want children for no other reason than to make them children of Christ cannot compensate for the virginity that has been lost. Following this, Aquinas contends that any form of sexuality that doesn't fall within the natural goal of the species, including homosexuality, incest, masturbation, or even improper sexual practices within marriage, are against God's law. Now, we may have freed ourselves from the long regime of sexual repression endorsed by Augustine and Aquinas and others, but as Foucault points out, we still live in a culture that focuses on sex and makes it a source of extreme anxiety. Sexuality suffuses the culture, and we are incited at every turn to determine ourselves as sexual beings. In this respect, we are still in the orbit of repression. And this is another reason why temperance remains an ambivalent virtue. What this brief survey shows is that there are at least two different ways of going wrong with temperance. First, a lack of temperance involves a lack of personal sovereignty and the inability to rule over oneself or others, like the tyrant who cannot control his desires and who is incapable of enjoying what he has. Complete satiety only produces disgust and signifies an inability to feel at home or at peace in the world. But the other way of going wrong with temperance involves too much self-control, which leads to self-hatred for whatever resists the will's commandment over itself, and the ultimate rejection of our physical nature. With Christianity especially, the split between our physical and our spiritual nature is often emphatic and extreme. The physical is opposed to the spiritual, and the very idea of a spirituality of the body, as in yoga, for example, is literally inconceivable. We cannot accept ourselves as we are, and for as long as we don't identify with our physical nature, it means that we don't have a strong connection to the natural world we belong to. Perhaps this is why temperance is a more ambivalent virtue today. Of course, we know that it should be a virtue, because there's something wrong with self-abandonment. But at the same time, we sense that the meaning it has acquired as self-control and even self-denial is impoverished and says nothing about our place in the world around us. Now, it's certainly the case that temperance requires an inner harmony and self-control. But the relationship to whatever is within us is always, at the same time, a relationship to whatever is outside of us. Temperance is not just self-fashioning for the sake of it. We are embedded in the world. This much is inescapable. And our sense of who we are is completely bound up with our sense of belonging to the world around us. Hence, as Socrates recognized, we need to stay mindful of our limitations, our lack of knowledge, and our mortality. We must not overreach ourselves or set ourselves up as if we were above nature to use it as a thing. And we should be able to enjoy what we have been given while avoiding the excessive pleasures and desires that lead to disgust or inner turmoil. In the end, this would also involve a sense of the sacred character of the world around us, which must be respected and cared for. All of this is contained in the ideal of temperance, but it certainly cannot be extrapolated from the imperative of self-control. Thinking of temperance as self-control only implies an inner turmoil which has just been overcome. Hence, I think it would be preferable to say that the deepest aspect of temperance involves an attunement to the natural order of the world. And this is reflected by the profound inner calm or serenity of whoever has achieved the proper harmony of the soul, like Socrates, as Plato describes him. This way of thinking helps to clarify the sense in which temperance belongs to the very basis of ecology, since it concerns our relationship to the world around us. It emphasizes the need to cultivate attitudes like frugality, a sense of limits and antipathy to waste, gratitude for whatever is given, and even a sense of the sacred as the proper attunement to the world, which expresses our own sense of belonging to it. Let's now turn to the present and the environmental problems that face us. Scientists all over the world have recognized for some time that species extinctions are now occurring on a massive scale. The rate of these extinctions seems to rival those of the Cretaceous period of about 65 million years ago, when many species, including the dinosaur, also became extinct. But while every other case of mass extinction in global history has come about as a result of climatic change or some cataclysmic event, the present crisis is entirely the result of human influence and has been caused by pollution, overdevelopment, and overpopulation, and an underlying lack of concern for the natural environment which all of these factors manifest. Some scientists and activists are now working to preserve the biological diversity of different local habitats, and environmental issues such as deforestation, overdevelopment, pollution, and global warming have been brought into public focus. More than ever before, we're asked to live mindfully and responsibly in the natural world, and to practice a policy of sustainable development that would keep the world in good condition for our children and for future generations of human beings who are as yet unborn. In very broad terms, this is environmentalism, and it is profoundly associated with the virtue of temperance insofar as it involves a harmonious attunement to the world around us, which reflects the same harmonious attunement that temperance achieves within the individual soul. The environmental movement has emerged in response to a growing sense of a crisis in the natural world. It is not the expression of a special interest, since it is concerned with the maintenance of biodiversity as an end in itself and as a necessary condition for the health and well-being of all present and future human beings. In fact, environmentalism forces us to change our focus from a purely anthropocentric point of view to the consideration of nature as a whole. As Aldo Leopold puts it in his famous formulation, a thing is right when it tends to preserve the integrity, stability, and beauty of the biotic community. It is wrong when it tends to do otherwise. Lying behind this is the idea that all the different aspects of the environment are ultimately interconnected. Anything that happens in one place eventually has some kind of an effect on everything else. While the natural world, both in its details and taken as a whole, is not an indifferent space, but a place of beauty and spiritual possibility that our attunement to nature allows us to celebrate. In the end, the whole of nature is an ecological community that we ourselves belong to. We already know this on a personal level. The food that I eat is food that someone else doesn't eat, even though they may be starving. Any fuel that I use now depletes supplies for future generations. And the way that I leave my city, my rubbish, or my world may have a marked effect on those who come to these things after I have gone. But we lose sight of this when we emphasize our domination and control over the natural world and assume that the world is just an object that is subject to us. With other cultural perspectives, such as Taoism or the Native American view, there is profound wisdom in the claim that the world does not belong to us, and we should assume an attitude of reverence towards the natural world as our home. This entails not harming it, cultivating a sense of gratitude for what we have been given, and recognizing the extent to which we are embedded in the world as one species amongst thousands of others. There are countless examples we could choose to illustrate the point that nature is an interconnected realm. But there are three basic issues that seem to recur again and again, namely pollution, overdevelopment, and species endangerment or extinction. This is not to say that environmentalism involves only these three issues, but insofar as we can distinguish them from each other, pollution, overdevelopment, and species endangerment seem to be the most common features of the environmental crisis we're facing. As an example of what happens when a species is endangered and undermines the ecological balance, we could take the recent decline of the vulture population in India. Once they were a common sight, but since at least 1999, the number of vultures has collapsed, and many scientists think they're facing extinction. Pesticides are blamed, but there's also a consensus that vultures are dying because the corpses of cattle they traditionally feed upon now contain hormone additives that are given to the cattle in order to boost their milk production. The vultures are poisoned by these additives, but as a result, the population of wild dogs has markedly increased as they feed on carrion that is now available to them. Many of these dogs are infected with rabies, however, and as a result, the number of Indians who die of rabies each year has greatly increased. Next, consider the problem of waste, including industrial waste, smog, and perhaps most dangerous of all, nuclear waste. Industrial production creates jobs, consumer goods, and other benefits, but in the long term, it's also destroying the stability, integrity, and beauty of the natural environment and endangering future generations of human beings. One prominent example would be the enormous amount of waste dumped into the Rio Grande River from U.S.-owned chemical plants operating in Mexico. Most of the residents of the Rio Grande area obtain their drinking water from the river. But there's a lot of unexplained sickness in this region, and the rate of anencephaly in border cities like Brownsville and Matamoros is four times the national average. Despite legal suits against the companies, however, the pollution continues, since residents have to be able to prove the specific linkage between the pollution and these conditions to shut the factories down. In the case of nuclear waste, the problem is even more alarming. Since nuclear waste will remain radioactive for thousands of years, any short-term measures for dealing with it, like putting it in the ocean or burying it in a mountain, are quite problematic, given the possibility of earthquakes and other disasters. Environmental concerns like this, which affect the well-being of many future generations, tend to affirm a strong sense of our place in nature and even within the cosmos as a whole. Finally, there's the urgent threat to global warming. There's now a considerable measure of agreement among scientists that global warming is caused by the erosion of the ozone layer surrounding the Earth, while this in turn is caused by the massive scale of pollution from toxic emissions released into the atmosphere by exhaust systems and other kinds of waste, which are the consequences of industrial activity and human overdevelopment. As a result of global warming, the seas will rise as the ice caps begin to melt, huge numbers of people and animal populations will be displaced or die in resultant flooding. Global warming will most likely affect the Gulf Stream and may even make it change direction if the warming is significant enough. And this could produce a global catastrophe as traditional ecosystems are suddenly altered or destroyed. These three examples out of thousands which could have been chosen show the extent of the interconnectedness of nature and how damage to one part ultimately affects the whole of the ecosystem. They show the importance of our attunement to the natural world, both on an individual level and at the level of humankind itself. Of course, human beings may gain a short-term advantage by disregarding their place in the natural order, by promoting overdevelopment that leads to pollution and environmental desolation. But in the long run, this path is bound for disaster. In this respect, then, temperance promotes environmentalism as the harmonious adjustment to the natural world. For even if one person's actions may not have a significant impact, the combined effect of millions of people acting responsibly does. Now, there's still considerable dispute about the extent to which intervention in the natural world is necessary and exactly which environmental policies should be followed in the world today. And environmentalism includes a variety of different perspectives, ranging from deep ecology to ecological feminism and several different versions of humanism. Nevertheless, all of these views presuppose temperance as an underlying virtue which promotes a harmonious relationship to the world around us, as something we should be concerned about in our desire to be good. There are three important aspects to consider here, and we can summarize them as the basis of our environmental philosophy. First, temperance promotes environmentally friendly attitudes and behavior like frugality, antipathy to waste, and humility. It also involves enjoyment of the earth, not overindulgence or the refusal of pleasure which would entail ingratitude, but the appreciation of simple pleasures which testify to our appreciation of the world around us. Next, temperance emphasizes the importance of attunement and a harmonious adjustment to the natural world and even the cosmos itself. In both a local and a global sense, it involves cultivating a sense of belonging and responding to one's place in nature. Finally, temperance also involves a non-appropriative relationship to the world. The world is not there to be dominated or controlled. It is to be appreciated for its own sake, and this implies a sense of wonder or an aesthetic appreciation of the natural world as a basic response that we may cultivate to affirm our sense of belonging. Temperance and environmentalism undermine the sense of an independent self that holds itself against nature as an object to be dominated and controlled. Putting this more positively, we could say in conclusion that temperance and environmentalism promote spiritual renewal both in the life of the individual and in the life of the community itself. In this paper, I've considered ancient and modern conceptions of temperance. I've argued that despite its recent decline in fortunes, temperance remains a significant virtue insofar as it concerns our proper relationship to nature, which leads to environmental concern. But this is not a new version of temperance, specifically revised to fit the problems of a new age. In both Western and Eastern traditions, especially such as Taoism, temperance has typically been construed as a mode of self-ordering that is focused on nature. This is the spiritual wisdom that temperance represents, and now it must be rescued from the negative forms of moderation, self-denial, and the refusal to enjoy life, which temperance has recently come to signify.